Randy, you're a well-known researcher. Can you tell me a bit about your background and the kind of research that you're focusing on?
My background is in what people will call formal artificial intelligence, formal in the sense of the use of mathematics and logic to represent information for machines and to reason about it so machines can draw inferences and use them to help support decision making. That's naturally evolved to work in a variety of things. These days, mostly applied to machine learning, which is really just managing large volumes of data, finding structure in the data and drawing inferences from that data. Three example areas. I've worked a lot in visualization of large data sets, that is using a visual graphical vocabulary to find structure in data. A lot of work in computational linguistics, that is in using large data sets to be able to derive language models so that you can make predictions about what sentences mean, for example, particularly relevant to search engines these days. And another area is in related to systems biology and genomics, that is using formal systems to understand the large volume of data we can create from biological objects and to interpret that data, again, to make inferences about them. So, for example, here's a collection of genes that Steve Moore in agriculture would say are relevant to the quality of beef, and can we isolate those, and can we isolate them well enough to be able to culture them in cattle as they're bred? So that spectrum of things.
What would you consider the highlights of your findings or discoveries?
I think that for me, the highlights that I think are most important is new ways of thinking about reasoning. For example, I was at the center of the development of things called abductive reasoning 10 to 15 years ago, which has become, if you like, the architecture for doing a variety of things, partly in machine learning, partly in, for example, automated diagnosis. So all of those underlying techniques have been used in a broad variety of applications, everything from stock market analysis to data mining from large data sets and your favorite grocery store to understanding biology. So I think it's the underlying processes of computation that have been most interesting. And I've had an incredible number of great graduate students, nearly 60 of them now. All of them have managed to do better than I can at any of the things that they've concentrated on. So they themselves have done an enormous amount of work. Most of them are senior researchers and professors around the world doing great jobs. So I count those as great accomplishments as well.
When I think about what's happened over the last 20 years with computers, I can still remember the day when they came into our office, took our typewriters away, plunked down computers and said, go to it. And I didn't even know where the on button is. And now everything is digitized. I'm completely digitized. From your perspective as a researcher in this area, what have been the big changes for you? What is the importance of this to our lives?
One of my friends at the German Research Center for AI asked once, he said, we now have the capacity to have recorded every sound and every word you've ever heard and every dialogue you've ever had since you were a baby, which means that you can always verify whether or not something was said or not, or whether you understood something correctly or not by going back through it. I think the biggest change is that we can store almost everything we know. And the neat thing about that is that we don't have to remember everything. So when somebody has an idea about something, there is immediately a repository that's accessible and that you can either confirm or deny or find evidence in support or find contradictions to the things that you're theorizing about. I think that by itself has probably changed the face of research and the face of culture and society more than anything else. And it changes more quickly for computer scientists because we fumble around in the dark first with these kinds of things.
Well, fumble in the dark, how do you get out of the dark?
By repeatedly fumbling. I'm a big fan of slogans, and one of the slogans that I think makes sense, especially when I talk to industrial people, I think many of my science colleagues sometimes have their heads too close to the ground, and they don't realize that the investments required to turn ideas into impact are much larger in the current kinds of cultures and communities that we have in kind of this sort of free market system. And so when the industrialists ask me what researchers at universities do, my answer in a slogan is make big mistakes fast at low cost. So back to fumbling around, we create advantage by demonstrating what won't work, what doesn't work. A scientific hypothesis that's proven to be wrong can be as valuable and can save us as much time, energy, and other resources as one which makes sense and we have evidence for, but we're not quite there with exploiting it yet. And I think we miss that. So by fumbling around in the dark, it's mostly saying our job is to have the integrity of a scientist to say, leave no stone unturned. Make sure you don't just go for the things that are popular and the flavor of the week. Make sure you understand as much as you can. And I think that's a better, sort of a broader description of fumbling around in the dark. You only get out of it by making mistakes.
You're also the president and CEO of iCor. And it's what, 4 years now since you've been that?
Since January of 2005. So yes, it'll be 5 years at the end of this year, I guess.
What is iCor?
iCor is basically a scientific research recruiting agency. You can think of it that way. Any jurisdiction of finite size, that includes everybody, but in particular small ones, can't do everything. They can't build basic research that supports diversity in an economy without focusing on something. There isn't a jurisdiction in the world that doesn't recognize the integral value of computing science, information communications technology. So iCor is formed out of this Premier's Council on ICT as a result of that in 1999 to ensure that Alberta built the capacity for high quality informatics or ICT to support all of the other things that were going on. So iCor had become, if you like, a fire starter, a catalyst for recruiting and building capacity in strategic areas to be able to ensure that we have world-class support for those strategic areas we want to do research in. Currently in health and health-related things, for example, health processes, health informatics, all the way to genomics, panomics, all of the omics in support of health. In the things that we do well, but we know we need better science to do better at, and that's in agriculture and forestry or the bio industries. And in one of the things that is the basis of our economy, energy now coupled with environment. So to do all of those things, you need a very strong basis of modern computing to be able to make progress because you can't compete in the world without that. So iCor by itself is just to help build that capacity.
Every time I come to one of the launches of a new iCor chair, you talk about the iCor Academy. What do you mean by that?
For me, what I try to knit together all of the iCor researchers. We have a yearly meeting. It's not an open meeting. It's a closed meeting, invited meeting, which all of the iCor chairs are invited, all of their postdocs, all of their associate colleagues, all of the graduate students. This is now over 900 people. And I liked to try to bind them together by speaking of the iCor Academy as a broad collection of broad thinkers across a spectrum of things all related to informatics. And I like to see them interact, and I like to see them lever each other to tackle new problems that they couldn't otherwise have tackled separately. A really good example is a quantum information theorist from Calgary, Barry Sanders, working with nanotechnology physicist Bob Wilco in physics at the University of Alberta related to NINT. Is if not for iCor, they wouldn't have talked to each other and wouldn't be working together. So the iCor Academy for me is my cajoling to 33 iCor chairs to interact with each other enough to see what new things they could find. And they're all top-rate scientists. So,
well, over the 10 years that iCor has been around, every year you're developing new research chairs. How many are there again?
iCor's made 33 awards. Some have been retired or completed. I think there are 28 active iCor chairs at the moment. To put this in perspective, when we project the costs of the support of these over, say, till 2014, the total cost is under $90 million. So when you hear about, for example, $300 million being allocated a few weeks ago to oil exploration for the year, that investment in base capacity seems like a very small sum, yet it's made a very great difference.
when ICOR does establish a chair, you always have collaboration from right. different companies and different agencies.
Right.
Can you give me some examples of those collaborations and how it is that you actually bring them about?
Part of building capacity is really managing a portfolio of the world's top senior leaders all the way through. So if you like full associate assistant professors, postdocs, graduate students, managing that spectrum of people and ensuring that you build teams. So, for example, the ICOR Academy consists about half and half of research chairs that have no particular industrial affiliation and the other half with specific industrial affiliations. So, for example, ICORG Chair Wilson Hsu is working on intelligent management of power grids. So there are all kinds of modern informatics techniques for machine learning that will help manage large systems, predict how they work, predict failure, adjust and self-diagnose to mitigate failure, and to more efficiently manage power grids when we've got influx of so many different kinds of power, all the way from wind power to coal power. In that case, that research chair is an industry research chair supported by an Alberta consortium of people interested in managing that power and in developing the talent to manage the modern power grid in a jurisdiction the size of Alberta. So there's an example of something where there's a vested interest by a collection of industrial partners who contribute money and get value out of this by working closely with a world-class researcher to get the first look at what's coming to be able to help them improve their management of the power grid and to be able to see the educated, so-called high-quality personnel coming out of there and taking jobs and managing this modern power grid in Alberta. So that happens in about half of the ICOR chair cases. About half of them are related to one industry or another. We have ICOR chairs related to efficiency in oil extraction, in the oil sands, for example, with Syncrude and Suncor. We have people involved with medical imaging with the Calgary Scientific and the University of Calgary and the Faculty of Medicine, with the Cross Cancer Clinic and analyzing imaging there for cancer treatment with the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning, of which I'm also a principal investigator in. So it's that those tendrils to places that are actually able to take these things and put them into practice. And that's the management of the ICOR portfolio, if you like.
Well, how do you broker those partnerships? How would it start?
I think the only components that you could think of as the components for the recipe are hard work, the willingness to work almost any time, and the willingness to listen well enough to find mutual value. So it is that you're brokering relationships between researchers, universities, and industry. And those can come about in the 16 or 17 cases that they've come about for ICOR in a broad variety of ways. So to give you an example, a Calgary company had come to ICOR and saying, we've been spending a little bit of money trying to make some progress on some research that we think is vital to our business, but we've been doing it in a contract-based way, searching various faculty members, engaging them as consultants, and making tiny progress. But we've decided we want to invest what it takes to get an ICOR chair to concentrate in these areas. Will you help us find that person, recruit them to Alberta, and we'll co-fund this chair and look for other leverage funding? So it comes from all the way from an individual researcher already in place who says, I've had a breakthrough in my research and there's so much interest, these industries will get together and support a chair, to an industry coming to ICOR directly and saying, what kind of leverage can we get with our money? We really need some accelerated research in this area. And it's gone the full spectrum that way.
Now, you talked about focusing on strategic areas. What would be some of those strategic areas?
The original areas, ICOR's labels, because of course people looking to raise research money for their research interests are always wary of the categories and labels. So when ICOR was first started, it was interested in broadly in quote intelligent systems, where we had a lot of investment, artificial intelligence, machine learning, managing large databases, in wireless communications, which was the full spectrum from managing internet protocols over both wired and wireless things, all the way to the design of wireless interaction protocols, data encoding, decoding, and even energy efficient antennas and transmission and reception. And so those areas started. They've evolved to now, when people ask me this, and what you will see on our website, is interests in what we will describe broadly as systems biology and health informatics. So that is in the areas of health, informatics support from the lowest level of assembling the outputs of current gene sequencing machines, all the way to managing health records. Another area is in Alberta has the label integrated resource management, which is largely complex modeling and sensing. So can we build a model of Alberta and some of its components? For example, model all of the forests so that we can predict what's happening with disease in our forests. And of course, another one is so-called cyber infrastructure, that is investments in large computing, in grid computing, in cloud computing, so that we can develop the infrastructure that supports all of the rest of the things that are going on. So for example, reservoir modeling, to be able to model reservoirs at the level of detail required, to be able to know that when we sequester CO2 in that reservoir, it won't leak and it won't come out. So that's the current spectrum of things. And you can see the evolution from the start with a basic focus on targeted, what really amounts to computing and information communications technology, now broadly across the spectrum to applications in medicine, engineering, and science.
What's cloud computing?
Cloud computing is the current label for storing all of your data and doing most of your processing on other machines. So your computer largely becomes a terminal, and you participate in this community, which can store much larger volumes of data, for example, than you can yourself. So cloud computing is that you're always connected to this very large network. Wherever you have an internet connection, you get access to your data. It doesn't matter through what machine, whether it's your iPhone or your laptop or your shared multiprocessor in a group. All of that has access to places where you can store and retrieve data reliably and get computation done that you can't do locally.
iCore has met specific needs for Alberta,
right. But
how about the world? What does the world think of iCore and what's happening here?
It's a good question, because one of the things that happens whenever a publicly funded agency is scrutinized, you always look to compare with other like organizations. So in fact, I've taken some responsibility for that. iCore's done some assessments and looked at other things around the world, and we've never found something quite like iCore. Here are some of the things that come back about comments about iCore. The basic structure of iCore is we're not a bricks and mortar organization, which uses a relatively small volume of public funding outside of the decision-making processes of universities to collaborate with universities and industry to find very good people in targeted areas. So it means what we've done is we've collaborated with universities in the public agenda to focus in areas that we believe are good for this jurisdiction. To give you an example of things that are often compared, compare National ICT Australia, which was formed with a similar goal in Australia, more broadly based. It has four labs in Australia. I think its budget is somewhere between $50 to $75 million a year. iCore's total budget over 10 years is under $90 million. If you do the same kinds of measurements, that is in terms of iCore productivity of its researchers, iCore has been much more productive. And one of the reasons is that NICTA spent money on developing buildings and labs in four places. They decided they wanted to be separate from universities, and they decided they wanted to build a structure that had infrastructure. Well, you would get no one at NICTA to admit this off of the public scrutiny. What they will inform you is that that money spent on buildings was probably better invested in research. But that's an example of a jurisdiction which had the same motivation for improving the base quality of capacity in ICT, but took a different tack to it. And so iCore has been more successful in that way by all of the standard measures, because what we did is collaborate with the infrastructure that was already there. The physical infrastructure of the university wanted to grow and wanted to get better, and iCore was a catalyst to do that. It's a little bit ironic and a little bit funny is that some consultants in the state of Washington were assessing capacity building and investments in research in the United States, and somehow they decided that ICAR was one of the best and most effective models in the United States. So while they got the jurisdiction wrong, they assessed the quality of what ICAR had done and how it worked, and said it was really effective for its size. And I've had these discussions with people around the world, in Australia, in China, in Japan, in Europe, and everyone agrees that this is something that's not easy to manage. But when the shape of the jurisdiction is participation from good universities and an agency that is not bricks and mortar, but somehow will glue everything together, that it can work and provide high value at low cost, I guess.
Can you list off some of the discoveries or important results that ICAR researchers have come up with that are of benefit to the world?
Oh, absolutely. Let me go through a spectrum of things. Let me talk about, four that immediately come to mind. So first, let me take from the original investments. The first ICAR chair, Norm Beaulieu, is one of the world's leading theoreticians in wireless communication. So he and all of his graduate students are in very high demand all around the world because they are amongst the best at understanding wireless communications. Let me give you an example. Even though he's a theoretician, the things that he has created with his students are now being licensed to a variety of companies around the world. A first example, the IEEE standard for wireless communications of the kind people refer to in North America, at least, as Wi-Fi. So when you walk into a Starbucks and you're connected by this protocol labeled 802.11, that protocol started out with a whole series of different speeds and underlying communications protocols to make it robust at those speeds. The current protocols and coding tables, these are tables for taking, if you like, the electronic signals, turning them into digital signals and back and forth. The current set of those now emerging in the chipsets to run 802.11 come from Norm's lab. Those will be in every chip in the world, right? So there's an example of somebody who's a leading theoretician whose work has gone from theory into use, and most of us will never know about it. But if you find that today you can get twice as much data in and out of your wireless connection, it's largely due to that kind of impact. There's just one example. Let me think of another one. Let me take a more recent one in applying machine learning to imaging. Ross Mitchell at the University of Calgary, who's in our Alberta Ingenuity Center for Machine Learning, has demonstrated the first non-intrusive, if you like, image-based biopsy. So there's a certain kind of brain tumor whose name is unpronounceable for a computer scientist. But that class of brain tumor can be treated quite effectively with one particular treatment. And it's been determined by a leading cancer specialist at the University of Calgary that there have been several cases where it's been determined by intrusive biopsy that the genetic makeup of that person is either amenable to this treatment or not. And that is, the treatment won't do anything. It may even make things worse. So by physical biopsy, that is taking a sample of brain tissue, they're able, after some analysis, to be able to determine whether or not this treatment will work. What Ross Mitchell has done is a world's first. It is by doing high-resolution analysis, applying machine learning to numbers of cases, he's been able to do virtual biopsies, that is, take images of these brain cancer patients and use imaging to determine whether or not the genetic markers are there. It's unheard of before. So you can essentially do a genetic analysis without intrusively taking a sample of brain tissue. It turns out that this image analysis technique is even more accurate than the actual physical biopsy. And so that's another amazing thing that's been done that way. So there's a second one. Let me think of other ones. Let's take Bob Wilco, the physicist. A couple of things there that are really interesting is Bob is also the kind of guy that's when you walk around and talk to him on campus, it's amazing because he always has his research and his physics in his head. He's always working with the most sophisticated equipment we have on the planet for observing things at the molecular and atomic level. And his passion is understanding atomic and molecular dynamics well enough to be able to control it. So back up to the abstract picture of nanotechnology, is not materials. That is the creation of materials of some uniform strength and properties, like absorbing CO2 10 times their structure size or something like that, are actually some of the simple consequences of understanding materials at that level. The more complicated ones are building dynamics at that level. So, for example, constructing a configuration of molecules which actually is active and does something, like a little tiny nano motor. Bob, that's Bob's passion. So to give you two examples, is at the Hewlett-Packard Labs in Palo Alto, one of the world's leading labs on nanotechnology. They've managed to create a single molecule transistor of a relatively large molecule. That is essentially building this Tinker Toy thing out of atoms that can be switched into a position and read to be on or off. Bob did that first with a smaller molecule at the University of Alberta as an ICOR chair. So he built the world's first single molecule transistor before two of the leading labs working on this at IBM and Hewlett-Packard. So that's another thing that he did. Another thing that's really interesting is two summers ago, if you typed in the world's sharpest point into a Google search engine, you would get back Bob Wilco's work on developing the probes for probing microscopes, where he developed a technique to be able to build a probe that was so sharp, the world's sharpest tip is a single atom. He developed the technique about how to shape these things using other molecules to shape this tip. One of the world's leading companies building these probing microscopes is Hitachi. They could not figure out how to do it, but he did. Now Hitachi has a joint relationship with Nint and with Bob to try to develop and further develop these here in Alberta. So there's a third example. I can keep going. A fourth example, maybe I'll put this one in, is that one of the ICOR chairs that we recruited is essentially what, if you think of Indiana Jones and Tomb Raider, you can think of Gene Wong and Gene Hunter. This is one of the world's leading genomicists. And what he's leading in is his work on identifying genomic structure in any biological organism in a way that is targeted to take advantage of it. So he is the initiator of the so-called Thousand Plants Project. And so he, with some of us, have worked to establish the funding in two phases to be able to develop this thing called the Thousand Plants Open Genome Database. On a scale unprecedented in the world, we're working on creating the genomic structure of 1,000 plants that will be put in an open source database available to everyone on the planet to be able to use those structures to further develop genomic applications and anything to do with plants. So there are three large areas. One is plants for fuel, one is plants for medicine, and one, of course, is plants for food. So we already know that there are lots of techniques for understanding how to engineer plants to make them better for what we want to use them for. This open source database is just turning the world upside down by saying we're going to generate the transcriptome database, that is the initial assembly of the genomic structures, so that anybody who's interested can take those and build businesses out of them. There are already people lining up to invest in the second phase. First phase is about $2 million. Second phase may be $100 million to actually do enormous amount of work on all of those areas, including environmental remediation. So it turns out that there are lots of algae that eat CO2. If we can use those at capture CO2 at the processes that create them, then we can take CO2 and put it in a little engine that generates other things that are of good value and destroys the CO2 or uses it as fuel. So that's another thing that's going on. So I guess I can go on and on.
All of this creativity, ICOR has provided an environment and an infrastructure to support this creativity. Is that in danger with the new changes that are being proposed through legislation to develop a new innovation framework for Alberta?
Whenever change happens, there will always be anxiety in those people who celebrate what's happening now. So you can go to every individual ICOR chair, and every one of them will have a certain level of anxiety about what will change and what might change and constrain them from operating in the way they operate now. So every last one of them is a highly productive researcher. There are other things many of them come from the School of High Maintenance, so it takes a lot of work to manage some of these people. But with that said, when the anxiety arises, it arises out of not knowing what the changes will be. When you talk to the people who sit at the base of the mandate for these changes, for example, Minister Horner, it is very clear that what they want to do is make things better. And so when you go to the highest level of the mandate for making change, and you trust that people want to make things better, and you talk at the level of the trenches, for example, of the ICOR chairs, of their anxiety about what will change, the important point is to connect those in a way that makes positive change to make things better. How that comes out is not always easy, and how it will come out this time is not always obvious. But I think that with enough people being vocal and clear enough about the value of what's happened, resolving their own self-interest and setting it aside, and we will take incremental steps to improving things.
Do you have any idea what the changes are for ICOR? Will there be an ICOR? Will there be an ICOR but with a different name? Do you have any idea at all what's happening?
Here are some of the things I think that I can say with confidence is, I can say with confidence ICOR will continue to exist. I can also say with relative confidence that ICOR's governance structure will change. Right now, ICOR is structured as a not-for-profit, board-governed Alberta company with one stakeholder, the Department of Advanced Education and Technology. So it's essentially a company owned by Advanced Education and Technology. How that structure will change is not clear. It may turn out to have a new board governance structure that might be broader, because there is a kind of a hint or indication that ICOR's structural success, that is how it recruits and places people, should be broadly applied to the other strategic areas of health, bioindustries, energy, and environment. And so I think there's an indication that ICOR will broaden and that it will have a different governance structure, but I don't think it's going to go away.
Well, for the time being, is it a question of staying the course?
Well, consider the timetable for the kinds of change that are going on. Currently, there are two things in motion. One is to redesign the system according to the public documents we've seen on the Alberta Advanced Education and Technology website. That is creating these four new board-governed organizations in charge of strategic assessment of what to do in the areas of health, bioindustries, energy, environment, and knowledge-based industries, technology, commercialization. In the course of this, ICOR will remain as a sort of a platform organization supporting all of them as a kind of capacity-building recruiting tool. So I think that that's pretty clear. So staying the course right now means considering how you would do that broadly. And in the timetable, which says create a transition plan starting maybe in the fall up to the end of this fiscal year, is when the transitions will take place. Then be prepared to shift, change, and broaden the ICOR mandate into these other areas, for example, and determine whether or not you replicate the ICOR structure to be able to work in these other areas, or you broaden the ICOR structure to be able to work in these areas. Renaming, not clear. But maybe renaming ICOR to be innovation, capacity building related organization, as opposed to what it started out with, ICT. Now that it's broadened to things across health and biology and environment, is to maybe do some appropriate renaming. Not clear. The ICOR brand is very well known around the whole world, so it would be a shame to lose that branding.
Well, aside from the sort of the political and structural changes that are happening now, what's ahead in terms of ICT and the kinds of things that we can expect to come up, whether it's through ICOR or a new organization or whatever? What's really down the pipe in terms of discovery?
I think that the answer comes back to what you asked before about what have we seen ICT changing. We're just on the verge of an era where we have the ability to create more data than we can absorb, but the ability to store that, sort of lurking on the edge of an ability to interpret that. And by that I mean we create an enormous amount of data, but we're very naive about how to use that data. Let me put it this way, is it used to be that machine learning, the area of artificial intelligence, which addressed whether or not a computer program could actually look at large volumes of data and adapt its behavior to learn from that data, that is, build abstractions. So, for example, from a robot being shown how to walk several times, could it actually learn to walk on its own and learn to run? Think about that as an analogy. What we're on the verge of is being able to concentrate on how to use the massive volumes of data that we have. For example, one of the physicists in Alberta at the University of Calgary is one of the leaders in developing the square kilometer array infrastructure, which is going to build a square kilometer array of sensors to sense external signals from the universe that we live in. That's going to create an enormous amount of data, but if we can interpret that data, we're going to learn an enormous amount about the world. It's kind of interesting that there's a leader in Alberta on that. But I think we're on the verge of being able to capture data in a goal-directed way, because we understand that computation is the only path between these large data volumes and making good decisions. The world is not structured in a way where the cleverest people by themselves are able to interpret the world. We need help. We already know that, right? We know the world would grind to a halt and that you would never be able to travel if the computer systems that manage airline scheduling went down. We see that whenever they do, right? And I think the next level of infrastructure is just to be better informed about, if you like, listening to the world and the data that it creates. We will know what to do with the mountain pine beetle because we'll be watching at a level of detail that says, here's what stopped its encroachment, here's what changed it, here's what we can use the results of their damage to, in a positive way, to create something that mitigates their impact, for example. Just looking at the world that way. And that's really, I think, the future is being much more connected to the data the world creates that we can observe and use it in intelligent ways. I think that's the future that drives especially the machine learning, artificial intelligence, and computer science people.
What do you like about what you do?
The background to that is interesting because the computer scientist works at a level of detail where the world is only information. The interesting thing about that is there a discipline which isn't based on the information that's extracted to perform the science or the engineering? So there's no biologist that would tell you that their biology isn't based on information. There's no physicist. There's no clinical practitioner. There's no sociologist that would tell you that their theories and what they do isn't based on information. The joy of being a computer scientist is that we can look at the world uniformly in terms of information, information gathering, capacity to store and process that information. And we can be, if you like, the people who can investigate new hypotheses more quickly because of the accelerated hypothesis managers we have as machines. In fact, today, one of the reasons that drug discovery and deployment will come down is because we actually have machinery that can do, if you like, virtual clinical trials. We have sufficient computing power to take drugs, which are largely complex proteins, put them in environments where we want them to act, which is largely models of the environments that they go into, your body, and we can do the triage and say, no, this will work, this won't work, these might work. We can focus that and manage those hypotheses in that way. And for me as a computer scientist, we're essentially the hypothesis managers for the rest of the world. And in the case of poor scientists, machines can do this better. In the case of great scientists, it's really their insight on a smaller number of hypotheses that accelerates their work.
Thank you very much, Randy.
You're welcome.